Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Syme, and the Scaling Tech Podcast is, as always, brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, providers of technical staffing and software development services in Latin America for our clients globally. For today's episode, I'm joined by Ritavan, author of the book Data Impact, How Legacy Businesses Save, Leverage, Line, Simplify, Optimize, and Grow. He's a data strategist with deep experience helping traditional companies modernize their data systems, not by chasing hype, but by creating real business value. And in this conversation, we'll dive into his SLASOG framework, which guides organizations through six critical stages of data transformation. Along the way, we'll also explore how engineering teams can become more forward-facing and business-aligned. So whether you lead data engineering or product teams, there's a lot to take away from Ritavan's practical and strategic approach to data impact. So Ritavan, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Aaron. Great to be here.
That's wonderful to have you here with me today. And for those of you watching us live, you can ask a question in the comments anytime and we'll address it. But I've got a lot of questions for you, so let's dive right into that. So Ritavan, you've worked with a lot of legacy businesses trying to modernize their data, many with big budgets, but little to show for it. What's one of the most common and costly mistakes that you see these companies make right out of the gate?
Yeah, I think what I had to do is also take a step back and to understand what's happening and sort of if you see sort of the two most common approaches. So on one hand, what I call spray and pray, right, which is like, let's try to scope out, you know, small use cases along the way. Let's try to build them out. Let's go step by step. And then, you know, hope we create value for our customers and hope, you know, yeah, that helps us win in the market. And on the other extreme, it's like, you know, let's plan a three-year digital transformation where we, you know, swap out our ERP system, swap out our CRM system. And that's what I call sort of boiling the ocean, right? So you're just trying to do everything at once. And it's really a practitioner's perspective, right? Like this is not something you would ever read about in a book, but I think having seen that over a decade and seen how horrendously bad the results are, and there's really studies done about this, you know, by interestingly consulting firms themselves, you know, all the big names do surveys, and then, you know, consistently you see failure rates of 90% plus. And then you have business schools, they try to compile these studies, and sort of the largest meta study I found was from IMD Business School in Switzerland. And they sort of compute in their meta study a failure rate of 87.5%, right? So let's just round it up to 90. And then the question is, okay, everyone seems to agree that empirically there are failures, right? That's what's happening. The question is, why are they happening? And like I said, I think the important thing is to understand what is the state of play and why are these two extremes taking place, right? So if you think about it, if we think the world is stochastic, right, is random and not completely knowable, then I think both these approaches represent two extremes on that spectrum, right? So the spray and pray approach is the world is completely random, you know, like we're tossing coins constantly. And so I will do one tiny step because I don't know what will happen. So you're assuming zero knowledge, right? And you're just trying to coin toss your way to success, which is right. Kind of absurd because we do know certain things about, you know, you do know certain things about your industry, you do know certain things about your customers. And if you don't know them, at least you can get to know them, right? By analyzing data, by finding patterns. So that extreme, I think, is the sprint pray extreme is counterproductive. But it's very justifiable because you can always say, hey, look, I don't make any assumptions. You can't blame me. You know, I'm trying out something small. If it doesn't work, so what? The problem is these are scoped and defined as quick wins, and which means you do one quick win after another quick win, but they're all failures. So you're coming up tails all the time, right, with your coin tosses. And so you've burnt a lot of money and not got anything for it. The other extreme is what I would almost call a Soviet style, you know, planned economy approach, right? So where for 3 years you try to lay out millions and and then you try to change everything at once. That also doesn't make any sense because that assumes the world is static, right? So just like one extreme, the spray and pray approach, assume the world is constantly randomly changing. The other extreme, assume that it's planable on such a long time horizon. And both of which don't make sense, especially since technology itself is changing at a much faster rate than 3 to 5 years. So that's, I think, a common problem that takes place and that just destroys so much value. And so the whole idea with the book was to say in the first step, inaction is actually your friend in the sense of, don't waste that money. And it's a bit like if I've been an operator for a decade, but I'm kind of inspired by how investors think, right? So my whole pitch is, as an operator, try to think like an investor and try to think like a resource allocator and a capital allocator. And one of the things you learn in investing, right, not speaking of day trading, I'm speaking really of longer term investing, where you're trying to compound value. One of the things you learn is inaction is your friend, right? Because if you log, there was Aswath Damodaran, who's the rock star dean of valuation at NYU, Stern Business School, and he said, show me your frequency of your trading and I will tell you how poor your performance is of your portfolio. And so that's one clear thing, right? So the more frequently you trade as a person, the more likely you are to lose money. And so it's a bit similar here, right? Which is if you go to these extremes and if you try to do too much without thinking things through, you tend to lose more money than make money.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, no, I like that. I mean, we talk a lot of times in like software development about like trying to fail fast, which I think in some ways I think it's at least a well-intentioned thing, right? The idea that we want, if we're going to fail at something, let's fail fast so we can learn from it, learn what, if what we tried was something the customers didn't care about, users didn't care about, then let's move on to something else. But it can be very easily, that mindset can be very easily abused into like a spray and pray approach of, well, we don't have any idea what our users want, so let's just throw out 10 things and see, right? That more like Soviet style, as you described, the world is not fixed at all. It's interesting.
If I may riff on the fail fast part, right? Because I think we formulate it as fail fast, but the idea behind is learn fast, right? The point is not to fail.
That's the better way to phrase it.
To learn through failing, right? But it's not like you want to fail, right? I think what happens very often is that dogma kicks in and you go like, oh, no. If it worked, then, we did it wrong. No, that's not the point. The point is, it's okay to fail, but the point is not to actually try to fail every time.
Right, exactly. A very, very good point for sure. Yeah. It's a depressing statistic that you shared there of 87% of digital transformations failing. And outside of digital transformations, I've heard similar statistics too around just like, again, like software or IT projects in general. In this case, I think the statistic was the 87% was like as judged by those involved in the transformation work. Similar statistics I've seen that kind of say, well, we judge the project as having been failed if it didn't meet the scope or it didn't meet the budget or it didn't meet the timeline. And like any one of those deems it as a failure, although you might say it was kind of like a partial failure, like maybe it did meet the functionality required, but it took 2 years longer and twice as much money, right? Do you have before we dive into this Lasswalk framework a little bit more, do you have kind of a metric that you would recommend as saying, what is success?
For me, it's really commercial success, right? Because at the end of the day, if you cannot align everything you do, like you need to have a clear North Star, you need to know why you're in the game, right? Because at the end of the day, you're not doing like, it's not a hobby, right? You're not doing it because you enjoy doing it only, right? You're doing it because you want to achieve a certain goal. So like take sports, take the military, take whatever you want, right? In sports, if the team dynamics are not aligned to winning, right? And winning, whatever the sport is, right, can be, scoring baskets, shooting goals, whatever, right? But that is your North Star metric. Otherwise, you shouldn't play, right? The same in the military, if you're not winning the battle or winning the war, there's no point, getting up to fight, right? You may as well stay home or just give up. And so I think that gets lost sometimes in organizations, in business, because, you know, we sort of end up looking at a project specs for the sake of the project specs, right? Or for the sake of interdepartmental budgets or whatever, right? And you know, that's all the messy reality of implementation. And I think you have, like, you know, on the day-to-day, you have to sort of play this, you know, in a very contextual way. I'm not, you know, can't disregard that. But what really helps achieve alignment is if you clearly have a metric that allow that aligns everyone, right? And an intent that aligns everyone to the goal. Because like you said, you know, it's the people involved who in all these surveys say we're not happy with the outcome, right? And so you could sort of be contrarian here, or you could be devil's advocate and say it could be that the project in an objective sense is brilliant. It's just that the people involved are not happy, right? And so from that perspective, like even if you sort of play devil's advocate and accept that thesis, the question I ask myself is then why are people not happy, right? Because suppose it is objectively good, then it's weird that people are unhappy. And so that sort of is the core, you know, of the align chapter, right? Which is, if something happens and everyone has a different point of view and is not happy, that means there is no alignment, right? And so the align step is super critical. And so the Slashout framework were actually born through, you know, through a first principles rethink of what's going on.
So you mentioned the align framework there, and so when you know you're using the acronym SLASOG, which comes, you know, it's in the book title as well, stands for save, leverage, align, simplify, optimize, and grow. So before we start to dive into a couple of those in more detail, can you walk us through at a very high level what those six steps of the framework are?
And Yeah, for sure. So save starts out by saying, look, pause, you know, some inaction is better than stupid action, right? So like, you know, from this investing sort of wisdom. So take a pause and you know, don't harm yourself more than you need to. But the idea there is really to avoid a lot of groupthink mistakes, because the bias for action at the outset is nice as long as it expresses a sense of, like, it's nice because it expresses a sense of agency, but it's problematic because it also means that you haven't thought through. And so very often you end up following, you know, like in the safest ways to follow best practices, or to call everyone in a room, you know, build some sort of group think consensus and then get started. But these are all not necessarily smart decisions, right? They're usually, in fact, poor decisions by design, because that's, you know, these kind of consensus group think processes or copy pasting someone else's approach logically just don't, you know, are not the best way to do things. And so save is really stop doing that, right? Then comes leverage, right? Because then, you know, the moment I tell you, okay, these are all things that are stupid, you shouldn't do them, then you would tell me, okay, brilliant, I'm convinced, but what should I do, right? Because like, what's the alternative? And so leverage starts with the alternative. And so it tells you, focus on your unique unfair advantages, right? Because instead of, you know, following sort of best practices, which is essentially copy pasting what other people are doing, right? And again, if you think as an investor, if you go and buy everything else that the rest of the market is buying, right? So if you own the index, you can't outperform the index, right? So if you invest in the S&P 500, by definition, you can't outperform the S&P 500, right? And so the other thing is also our needs are different, right? So that's what they teach you in personal finance also, is that you are at a stage in life where you might need a certain kind of portfolio, a certain kind of liquidity requirement, et cetera. A younger person, you know, right out of uni is at a different stage. Someone, you know, already in retirement has different needs. And so you need to sort of think from first principles around what your strengths are and what you, you know, and what you want to achieve. And so that's the leverage step, right? So focus on your unique unfair advantages. And the other important thing is you are in a competitive market, right? We get too lost in engineering metrics like, you know, specifications, speed, timing. And these metrics in of the, you know, they're important metrics, right? But they're not in a vacuum. These metrics are basically so you win in a competitive market, right? And so you need that connection between these technical metrics and what you want to achieve to win in the market is what leverage sort of forces you to think about. And then you go to align, because now that you know, now that you know what your unique unfair advantages are and how you can leverage them, right? You've kind of drawn the bullseye. Now you want to align everyone, right? So now you align everyone to that bullseye and you get everyone to go in the same direction. Because if you don't do that, then you're not going to be ever going to reach your goal, even though you might have identified a nice goal to go towards. And the next step then is simplify, right? So now that everyone aligned, what happens very often in the alignment step itself or over time, right, during execution is complexity grows. I just riff quickly to explain what that means, because everyone goes like, oh, okay, but, how does complexity grow? It's not like people wake up in the morning and say, oh, let me try to increase complexity today, right? So, so what is, what mechanism results in complexity growing in an organization? And there's the excellent work by Joseph Tainter, studied the rise and fall of civilizations, et cetera, from the point of view of energy economics and complex systems. And so his findings point to the fact that complexity is born through problem solving, right? So if you have an organization, a civilization, whatever, right? Any large complex system, something will break somewhere, someone will try to do the right thing by fixing it, right? But as people do that at scale, that's how complexity is born. And now if you think about it, actually problem solving is the decentralized error correcting mechanism of any system, except that the error correcting mechanism in this case has an externality, is creating a problem, which is the growth of complexity, which means reducing complexity, which means simplification is an executive priority, right? Which means that if you're in any kind of leadership role, right, you have to have some kind of framework or some kind of goal for yourself that actively reduces complexity, because if you don't, you're not doing your job, right? Just because of the dynamics, we spoke about. And after simplify, right? And the reason why you want to simplify is because you want to remove the clutter, right? Because if you think about it, there's a cost of operating any system, the cost of just surviving and your metabolic rate, right? And so that's what you want to bring down, because if that goes out of control, it doesn't matter how good you are, you're just going to die, you're going to collapse. And so you want to bring that down. And one of your former guests and also, an author with whom I wrote the book, I think Lou Franco, Lou's argument in his book is also, when you speak of tech debt, don't look at it like debt in an account that you're trying to pay off. It's the friction, it's the current against which you're swimming, right? Very high level, that's sort of his book cover. And it's a similar idea here, but just beyond just tech debt, but, organizational debt or whatever you want to call it, like it's at the higher scale that you want to ensure you reduce complexity through simplification. That brings us to the optimized step, because now that you've stopped wastage, you've identified your unique unfair advantages and you're leveraging them, you've aligned everyone to them, you've removed all the clutter. Now what logically makes sense is to optimize, because you say, okay, that's how I kind of really squeeze the lemon as hard as I can, because you want to have as much lemonade as possible. And the last step is grow, and doing all of this effort is at the end only meaningful if you want to grow, because if you don't want to grow, then why bother, right, with all of this? And so grow really focuses on the fact that you have to understand and align and be inspired by all the insane opportunity you have in front of you and what you can achieve, right? And that's sort of that's what closes this flywheel.
That's great. Yeah, thank you for that overview, Rivan. Appreciate it. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned our mutual friend Lou Franco too, who's been a guest on the Scaling Tech podcast, talking about tech debt, as you said. And it's a great analogy in my mind, because the problem with tech debt and tech systems in general, right, is that there's a certain amount of like natural entropy, perhaps, a sort of descent towards chaos in systems as things need upgrades that we put off, perhaps as the usefulness of features, degrade over time, and as people kind of try to keep fixing things and creating, unintended problems around that. So I like how in your framework here, you have these proactive steps built into it for simplification, to, you know, have a space where you're, it's where you are proactively trying to manage that before it gets too bad, right? So I think that's great. I also want to dive in a little deeper on a line in a moment, but before that, I want to talk, you know, ask a quick question about the save step too, because I like how you emphasize saving rather than spending as the first step, right? You know, this is where you've used the phrase about inaction being a good thing sometimes, which I like. What are some kind of quick wins that companies can look for in the save stage that kind of help create momentum for the rest of the journey for them?
So here's actually my contrarian take on this, right? Which is that the point in save is not to waste money. And so that is your quick win as much as you can have a quick
That's
win.
That's enough, that, right?
That in itself is the quick win. Okay, but let me unpack that a little more, right? So so this is post the book, you know, going out into the world, etc. I've been reflecting on this quick win because it's a question I get commonly asked, right? Which is like, hey, tell me what's a quick win. And it's happened to me so often, you know, I'm sitting with a board member of, you know, a large bank, and their first thing is, look, I'm a very practical guy. I don't want any theory. Give me a quick win. And now if you think about it, right, in any other industry except ours, now if I were a financial advisor and I walked up to you, Aaron, and I said, or even on your podcast, I said, Aaron, I'll give you a quick win, you know, give me 10 grand, I'm going to double it. Your first reaction is going to be, this guy's a scamster, right? Like, because there are no quick wins in life, right? Now let's say I'm a nutritionist, right? And I come to you and say, Aaron, I'm going to make you lose 10 pounds in 2 days. And then you go like, okay, this sounds sick. Like, there's no way I'm going to be doing this because it's going to kill me, right? Or it's going to damage my health in some way. Or you know, a fitness trainer, right? I come and say, Aaron, you're going to have like a six pack in like 5 days and you'll have big biceps. And you go like, boy, that's something fishy there, right? So in every other scenario in our lives, right, we clearly do not believe that there is anything like a quick win. And so my question to our, you know, our community and our industry is then why the flying F to are we looking for quick wins all the time, right? So we're clearly chasing something that by design is the wrong goal, right?
Right.
But it's not enough, again, to just say what's bad. Let me sort of try to also point in the direction that makes more sense, right? So the question is not, how do I get a quick win? Meaning, how do I get a, you know, how do I get a six pack in like 5 days? The question is, what are my health metrics today and how do I get healthier? Right? That, or like, you know, if you're taking a financial advisor's perspective, you know, if I have 10 grand today, how can I compound it at, you know, S&P 500 plus 2% over the next 20 years, right? Whatever. So you want something that makes sense, that allows you to grow and that allows you to compound, because the magic of compounding only takes place over longer periods, right? I can't compound in one iteration. That does not make sense. And so if you even believe that a quick win exists, right, then by design, it cannot be something that compounds. Right. So you want to find some mechanism that compounds, because that's how value creation happens. Right. Yeah. The quick win thing does not work. Or even in running, right? If I said, Aaron, I'll make you win the marathon, you're going to sprint every 100 meters at your fastest possible speed. And you were like, no, that's not how marathon runners, like, they pace themselves. Right. So the idea is, you know, like, this quick win thing is dangerous. It's the wrong frame of mind, right? It's the wrong goal for a whole bunch of reasons. Okay. So that's sort of my take on quick wins. Instead, think of big wins, right? And big wins have to take place over a certain amount of time. And that makes you question what can compound for you. And especially with data, that's important, because a lot, you know, and it's another sort of, you know, cliche in the industry, I think, that destroys value, is data is the new oil. Right. But like, oil depletes when you use it. It's a commodity. Right. If I have two data sets, if I have on one side, I don't know, all my customer usage data and their behavioral data. And on the other hand, I have, you know, I have HR data on who has gone when on vacation in the company. Right. That's not this is not, you know, they're both data, right? But it's not a commodity. One is way more valuable in theory, right, with what you can do versus the other. And so, And so I think there's a lot of cliches we have kind of tied ourselves up into, and they are preventing us from actually seeing the light, you know, like, and I'm not saying I'm not saying I'm some kind of prophet or something, right? Far from it, right? But all I can say is, like, there's no point sort of, you know, entangling yourself to a point that you cut out any opportunity to find some kind of meaningful truth for yourself.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That makes sense a lot. I like it. All right, well, let's dive a little deeper on the align step. You know, we're not going to have time to go deeper dive on each of the steps. That's what your book is there for. And so certainly recommend people checking that out. But I want to deep dive on a couple of them here. So on the align step, I thought this one was interesting to engineering managers, our audience, because it speaks to the importance of translating product vision into something that customers actually value. And so I like how you described this step as a bridge between traditional work, traditional data work, and business outcomes. So let's talk a little bit more about the alignment step. Maybe starting by, you know, what are some common ways that legacy businesses fail to align their data efforts with core business metrics?
So align, like we discussed, is critical because, you know, unless you're working alone, you have to work with other people, you know, whether they're internal to your company, whether they're external, doesn't matter, but like you have to work with others, you have to collaborate in some form. So, and even if you don't, right, even for yourself, if you're working alone on something, you still want something that aligns you with what you want to achieve, right? So it's you with your goal or with more people, that's more complex, but not in each case, you need some form of alignment to something, right? To something you want to achieve, to your goal. So, what happens a lot of the times, and this, you know, this is really from lived experience operating, is it's always, you know, you're either good at building these interpersonal relationships with the key people involved, and then, you know, if you're good at that, then you get it done, and otherwise you don't get it done. But that's a very risky way to run an organization, because not everyone who is good at certain things is necessarily good at interpersonal relationships, not, you know, et cetera. So like, that's not a winning strategy, right? So now the question is, how do we go about it? And what I argue is, why should we reinvent the wheel when when we can learn from organizations that have operated for thousands of years and that have operated at the most insane scale imaginable? And for me, that's the militaries, right, around the world. And militaries have been around for thousands of years. Militaries have a very cutthroat environment they operate in. So you can't tell me, suppose I said nonprofits, you would be like, but look, that's not, you know, it's not competitive. So, but with militaries, no one can argue that the stakes are not high. That's the highest possible stakes in many ways. And the scale, right? So the scale of militaries is usually, you know, there's no private company that comes anywhere close to that ever, right? So I go back to the military and say, okay, how do they achieve alignment, right? And how have they developed their mechanisms for alignment? And so one thing that sort of stood out to me and that I've also applied when operating is what's called commander's intent, right? And so it's a concept from the military where basically you don't communicate instructions. So you don't say, you know, you do this and the other person does that or whatever, right? It's a lot more about bringing everyone to the table, putting out all the facts, and then making sure everyone has understood what's going on, right? What needs to be achieved, right? What's the goal? What is the working hypothesis based on which you start working, right? Very often you realize alignment collapses right at the start of a project or the development of a product because people are not starting with the same, you know, working hypothesis, which you can evolve and develop and learn, right? But like, if we don't even know like what our working assumptions are when we get started, we're already misaligned. And so there's these very basic, super obvious things, you know, it's not rocket science, but if you do this, if you follow it rigorously, it will just raise the level of alignment, right? It's not gonna be perfect, of course, but it definitely is a, you know, time-tested, rigorous framework that helps you achieve alignment. And there's a really nice anecdote, I think, that drives this point home. From someone who's arguably the most successful, you know, land battle commander, you know, in European history, which is Napoleon Bonaparte, right? And And Napoleon developed this method. And, you know, this is, yeah, I got this from the U.S. Marines archives. So I'm not a historian, and there's no way I was not in the tent with Napoleon, so I can't say he actually did it. But at least according to the U.S. Marines, he, in his general staff, would keep an old illiterate foot soldier. Right. And these words matter, right? Why? Because he's old, so he doesn't know the latest, you know, tactics. He's not into the lingo. He's, you know, there are generational differences. So you want to make sure you cover everyone, right? You take sort of the lowest common denominator as far as knowing stuff is concerned. Foot soldier is important because he might not be super trained, might not have gone through all kinds of training that other officers go through. And now come illiterate, which is super critical, which is they don't even know how to read. Now, why is that important? Because in battle at that time, you would communicate orders verbally because it's just way faster, right? And on the battlefield, you cannot say, oh, hold on, I need to take out my notes, and then you start reading and continue fighting. So it has to be all verbal and fast and super well understood and achieve alignment to win the battle. And so he would get the orders read out to this guy before sending them out. And if this guy, and then his the job of this guy was to explain it back to Napoleon. And if the in the way he explained it back, if that was not satisfactory, he would send the orders right back to the generals for drafting again. And so he would do this until he was convinced that what he had in his mind, that intent, was clear across the entire organization, right, across the entire corps. And what I joke is then, you know, if you can get the infantry, the cavalry, the artillery, and everyone else to work together, right, I'm sure you can get product marketing and engineering to work together, right? If you follow the right framework, right? I mean, then it's because this is not political, right? As long, you know, once you have a clear North Star metric, which is the other step in a line before you go to the commander's intent, which is you need to have clear quantifiable ways of saying what your goal is, how you achieve it and all of that. And then, right, the commander's intent is your framework to help everyone get there.
I like it. I like it. Yeah, I like that recommendation of, you know, as Napoleon did, of having kind of someone repeat it back to you, basically, and making sure that that is a message that conveyed well across the whole team and across different types of roles and knowledge.
If I may riff, right, let's just apply it quickly to our context, right? So if you can get in, if you, once you transmit this, if you can get an engineer to explain it to a marketer, and then you can get a marketer to explain it to an ops person, and the ops person explain it back to engineering or R&D, that's for me, that's the equivalent, right? If you can get that to happen, you're already super aligned, right? Then, you know, yeah, the probability of things blowing up is much, much, much lower.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the other thing I like about it, I think it answers, helps address a question that I had of kind of when you are, you know, when you're giving teams the like commander's intent, you're giving them North Star metrics and helping them understand the why of the technical work that you're doing into you. You know, generally speaking, I would say you want to avoid, as a leader, slipping into micromanaging how they do that. And I guess that, you know, I think, you know, tell me if you agree, what you just described is one way to help prevent slipping into micromanaging and how it's done. Because if you if the marketing person and the, you know, the data analyst and the software developer all have to agree on what the commander's intent is, then they all have a vision of you know, what they need to produce as results, right? Without having been told, because the marketing person is not going to tell the data analyst how to do their job and vice versa. But if they all understand clearly the goal they're working towards, then they, as experts in their discipline, can come up with the best way to implement.
Let me use another example, right? Outside, again, I think very often it helps us as a community to see how things can be better and much easier by looking outside, right? Let's take the sports analogy, right? So Aaron, you're the coach of pick whatever sport, right? Football, soccer, basketball, rugby, whatever, right? You pick your sport. Now, you're supposed to run a team. Before you go into a match, can you tell them exactly at which second they need to do what? I mean, you don't have you don't have a Jira board in sport, right? But suppose you had a Jira board, would you do that? That's not a winning strategy, right?
Right.
And sports is competitive. Again, you can't tell me, oh, look, this is, you know, this is like fun. It's a hobby. It's a path. No, this is super competitive, right? You're playing to win. And so if you can't do it in other environments, right, that are similar, well, realistic, right? Because business is competitive. Business is in a crowded market. Business is about limited resources, et cetera, et cetera. So all of that holds true, right? So why do we assume that we can now engineer the hell out, you know, like we can micromanage the hell out of engineering? Like logically, it doesn't make any sense, right? And once you have this alignment, and now you look at the best coaches that I had recently, you know, Adrian Stock, who's, you know, who was ex-chief automation officer of GXO Logistics, the third largest, you know, the largest third-party logistics provider in the world. And he's just moved to as CEO Americas to a robotic automation company called High Robotics. And what he was sharing was a rugby coach, the South African national rugby team's coach, and how, you know, with the exact same players they had, you know, they were at rock bottom, they're losing to teams around the world and losing very badly, like 3-38 or, you know, that's something like that. And he comes in with the same players, it's the same stuff. He comes in and he gets them to win the World Cup like within a year, I think, and then win it again 4 years later. And so you realize very quickly, it's not about the resources. It's not about the effort you put in. It's another kind of magic happening here, right? Which is empowering the individuals, right? But also aligning them. Because if you only empower them, then you get some kind of chaos, right? So you want to empower them, but you want to align them. And you want the shared sense of like purpose, vision, and all of that. And have it quantifiable. And if you do all of that correctly, right, and you're playing to win, you know, then it, you know, we see that across sports. You know, you have small teams, not well-funded teams, they go on to win championships.
Yeah, excellent. No, that's a great analogy. I like it. So let's move over to the optimize step now. This is the next area I want to give a little deeper attention to in the time that we have. So engineers love to optimize things, right? So I think this is another area of interest to our audience of engineering managers and engineering teams. What does optimizing mean in the context of Slashdot, and how does it differ from, if it does, from typical optimization conversations in data science or in product teams?
Yeah, so it's the idea of optimization is like given a certain, like it, in a very abstract way, right? It's given a certain setup, try to get the best possible out for whatever you want to achieve, right? That's sort of the core idea. And I'm not speaking of like fine tuning a machine learning model or something like that. That's not what I mean by optimize. What I mean by optimize is, you know, developing an empirically valid, mathematically optimizable model of your world, right? And then why is that important, right? And I'll give you a common example where, you know, with this pray and pray approach in companies, people build, you know, one machine learning model for lead generation or lead ranking, another one for channel optimization, a third one for customer retention, etc. Now, if you think about it, take a step back, what's going on mathematically here? Each of these, any kind of model, right? You call it ML, AI, whatever, doesn't matter. At the end, there is some kind of mathematical optimization routine that's trying to, you know, maximize some target function of sorts, right? So now if you take a step back and you see all these things strung together, then you ask yourself the question, but what are they optimizing towards, right? Like most of the time, many of these things are actually in direct conflict, right? If you try to increase something, something else goes down. But then if you don't model that in, right, if you don't have a valid, empirically valid sort of abstraction of your business, right, and of your market that allows you to understand these things, then you can be very good at developing, you know, and deploying models into production, machine learning models into production, or data-driven algorithms in general, right? You're still not going to get the outcome you want, right? And so the core idea of optimize is to build a layer of abstraction, right, of your business, of your strategy. A lot of people also tell me, hey, what's a strategy? And for me, a strategy is really, you know, it's when you abstract execution to a point that you have an empirically valid, you know, optimizable model, and that allows you to operate. And then you communicate that across the org, right? And so the optimized step really focuses on that, is that if your worldview, right, with which you're operating in your company and in your market, if that is not aligned with reality, it does not matter how beautifully you do everything else, it's not going to work, right? That's the first step in optimize, which is like have the right worldview. The next step is once you know you have the right worldview, then don't hold back, right? Because you have modeled in all the edge cases, you have modeled in all the, you know, all the downside, or you have hedged the downside, right? then go for the win, right? Then don't hold back. Because what happens very often, right, if you look at us also, we're programmed evolutionarily not to go crazy all in into one thing, because if all our ancestors who did that are dead, right? And so we're really genetically programmed not to maximize any kind of target function as human beings, because anyone who did that disappeared, because we, you know, as a species, we've evolved on a planet where we were not in control of our environment. And in many ways, we still aren't, right? Just go and experience a hurricane, go and see a volcano erupt, and then it puts the fear of whatever you're scared of in the world into you. So you're still not in control. But in business, most of the time, you can model a lot of stuff, right? And if you're not sure about something, you can modularize the uncertainty, right? And work around it. And so it's intellectually lazy not to bother doing that, right? It's not sexy. You cannot say, oh, we're now AI native or whatever. No, but at least you have a rational, sensible model of the market you're operating in, right? And so that's sort of the idea in Optimize, is to not skip this step, because if you skip this step, then you're going to run against the wall at some point.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about a case study that you talk about in the book. You talked about how Instacart went from being a grocery delivery business to also unlocking revenue streams around advertising. Can you walk us through that case study a little bit?
I think this is a general trend. And to ask myself the question, right, which is that how do you really, in the purely data driven paradigm, right? If you say I want a business model that's purely data driven, right? How do you make money? And the two most common things you see around are two things. It's like one, monetizing purchase intent, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like, I think someone wants to buy this, and then I basically package and sell that information to someone who actually wants to sell the thing, right? So I'm selling the demand basically. And the other thing is you sort of layer up, you kind of skim off margin from payments, right? So people, you add some layer of payments on top, right? And so the Instacart example is, they were delivering groceries from point A to point B, and you could order, and that's a very capital intensive, and, it's a very hard business with low margins, et cetera. Let's just draw a quick parallel. That's exactly how, the legacy airlines business works. It's like they don't make any money, and anyone trying to optimize, the yield per seat or whatever, you can look at all these metrics, no airline really makes money there, right? The same with Instacart. What they figured out is, hey, we have all this data, right? Like the point is not to just bring the grocery, the point is to know who wants to buy what when, right? And who is willing to pay us for that, right? That's the same thing with loyalty programs, right? So you might price compare, but at the end, if you're part of a loyalty program, you're probably going to pick that airline, even if it's slightly more expensive, because, hey, you might get access to the lounge, right? Or you might get upgraded or whatever, right? Yeah. Or you can exchange those miles someday for some other service, to go and buy a bottle of wine at duty free or whatever, right? So, and on top of that, what they're doing is once they have you in their loyalty program, they're essentially selling your miles. They're like a central bank, right? They're selling your miles to credit card companies, to insurers, to whoever else is interested in offering you products and services, right? And so Instacart basically does something like that. And a lot of companies do that, right? Because you cannot, in a highly competitive or regulated market, you cannot really survive and thrive and grow as a business unless you build up a new business model. And that's why I also argue, right, you cannot transform a business in the sense that, it's not a caterpillar that's going to suddenly become a butterfly, right? It's like you have your traditional legacy business. Now ask yourself, how can you really build a data-driven business that is, that kind of leverages it, but is different from it? Because you can't take Instacart cannot, it's not like they're data scientists that are driving bicycles and delivering stuff, right? Or, it's not. So it's two, these are different things, right? Like, let's not try to mix them up. Let's not try to change things. You don't have to do, innovation sort of theater everywhere. And that's sort of the idea with Instacart. And I have a whole bunch of case studies like this that sort of try to elucidate the fact that, you have a legacy business, you need to run it well, but that generates proprietary unique unfair advantages for you, which in this case, you know, a lot is around customer data and customer demand. And once you get that, you can now ask yourself the question in the data-driven paradigm, right, where replication costs are zero, where personalization costs are tending to zero, right? How do I create more value for my customers?
Absolutely. Excellent. Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And we're nearing the end of our time here together, unfortunately. So I want to ask, you know, are there other like closing thoughts that you want to share, or any other aspects of the SLASLOG framework that we haven't covered that you want to make sure that you emphasize today, since we really only got to dive deeper into like align and optimize?
Yeah, honestly, I think it's like, you know, I've written the book so that you can read it in 2 hours. If you're a slower reader, then perhaps 3 hours. It's really designed to be read and even skimmed through. You know, if you come across an example, a case study where you're like, I'll come back later, then skim through, you know, move on. But the idea is like, just go through it once so that you have a mental model that you can, you know, that's born out of the operating experience, that's sort of designed as a first principles way to look at things and start applying it, right? Because I didn't write this book because I want to call myself an author, right? I wrote this book for you. And I think the idea in this podcast was sort of to show you how a lot of problems, I think, that arise are often because we've tangled ourselves in our own, you know, echo chambers. And there's a whole lot of like very straightforward, simple stuff, right, that helps you solve it. And I don't have all the answers either, right? What I'm trying to give you is, I'm not giving you a recipe that you blindly follow, right? I'm not even giving you a map. What I'm trying to give you is the principles of map making, right? Which I want to be very clear about, right? Since we're among technical people, I don't know your truth, right? You are in a very sort of, you know, each one of us is operating in their own very, very contextualized environment. You need to think from first principles about your environment, meaning I cannot draw a map for your neighborhood. You need to draw a map for your own neighborhood. What I'm trying to give you is principles on how to draw a map, right? But I think if you draw a map, I think you will be much smarter than someone who's trying to go around without the map, right? And that's sort of the idea. That's the spirit of all of this.
I love it. That's great. I do definitely recommend the book, Data Impact, How Legacy Businesses Save, Leverage, Align, Simplify, Optimize, and Grow, and teach you some map making around creating data impact in your organization. I think you've also done some workshops around the SLASLOG framework as well. How can our listeners learn more about your work or workshops or get in touch with you?
Follow me on LinkedIn. I think I'm relatively active there, and then I'd keep you informed. And otherwise, just go to rithwan.com. There's always going to be something there. There's going to be a bunch of free resources, perhaps paid resources. When I do workshops, I post about it on LinkedIn. And the idea of workshops is really to have these kind of conversations, but not like one-to-one like me and Aaron are having, but like just have it with more people and sort of, you know, speak about your concrete problems and settings. And for me, it's fun because, you know, like I said, I didn't write this book for myself. I wrote it for you. And it's sort of my way to sort of, you know, share that with you. So
excellent. All right. That's Ritavan.com to learn more about the book. And thank you so much for joining me today, Ritavan. Really enjoyed the conversation, and best of luck to you with the book. And to all of you watching today's episode of learning how to create more data impact in your organization, go check out this SLASLOG framework. So thanks again, Ritavan.
Thank you, Adam. It was fun. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Excellent. Well, this conversation, like all of ours on the Scaling Tech Podcast, will be archived on the Scaling Tech Podcast YouTube channel. To learn more about other episodes of the Scaling Tech Podcast, be sure to follow us on YouTube and the podcast platform of your choice, as well as visiting scalingtechpod.com. Bringing the Scaling Tech Podcast to you. At Agility Feet, we help companies to build technical teams across Latin America. We can help you with everything from staff augmentation all the way to establishing your own technical center of excellence through our build, operate, transfer model. And we can do that for you in Colombia or elsewhere in Latin America. So check us out at agilityfeet.com to learn more. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the Scaling Tech Podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you're listening to this episode. We'll continue to bring you insightful conversations about engineering leadership and building technical teams globally.